Now, it may only comprise five words, but it's surely one of the most arresting statements that you will find in the Bible, indeed that you will find in any piece of literature. The statement to which I refer is in Revelation chapter 21, verse 4, and this is the statement, "Death shall be no more. Death shall be no more." Things, as you know, are quite difficult in France at the minute. The economy there is on its knees. Recently, the Prime Minister was ousted as Parliament passed a vote of no confidence in him. The President's position is looking increasingly precarious. But amidst the gloom, there was one bright moment for France and for President Macron this month, the reopening of the Notre Dame Cathedral. You remember how in 2019 a devastating fire raged through that cathedral, and it was just days or possibly even hours later that President Macron made a defiant announcement. The building, he said, will be restored in 5 years. It raised eyebrows across the world. It didn't seem possible that by 2024 that architectural wonder would be gracing once more the Paris skyline. It felt like a reckless, unrealistic, ridiculously overambitious claim by the president. But I mention it in order to make this point. That claim in April 2019, that claim which, as I say, took the world somewhat by surprise, it is banal. It is yawn-inducing compared to the claim that we have here. Death shall be no more. Death shall be no more. President Macron has never stood in front of the cameras and announced that. As far as I'm aware, even President Trump, who is never one to hold back when it comes to bold claims, even he hasn't made this one. I mentioned a moment ago eyebrows being raised, but what we have in Revelation 21 verse 4 is not an eyebrow-raising claim merely. No, either it's distastefully, grotesquely idiotic, or it's beyond momentous. It's sensationally, world-changingly epic. Now, we are Bible-believing Christians. We are Bible-believing men and women. We are not, therefore, those who groan and shake their heads and roll their eyes when the Bible throws up a claim like this one. We are those, rather, whose eyes dilate and whose pulses race at such a claim. Because it's serious. Revelation 21:4 means it when it says death shall be no more. And so, with our dilated eyes and our racing pulses, I want us to explore this surpassingly extravagant claim, drawing as we do so on the material that surrounds it. And notice with me, first of all, then this morning, the time. The time. In 5 years, Notre Dame will be restored. That was President Macron's claim. Well, when then is Revelation 21, verse 4, claiming that death shall be no more? What's the timetable when it comes to this claim? Well, it's clear in the passage that it's going to coincide, death being no more, it's going to coincide with a major transition. What sort of transition, I hear you ask? Well, according to the passage, there's going to be a passing away. Notice that phrase is used twice. It's in verse 1 and it's in verse 4. There's going to be a passing away of the whole present order. The present order is referred to in these verses by the adjective first. The adjective first is used three times. Although in verse 4, the ESV translates it former, but it is, again, that Greek word first. So in the terms of this passage, then, what exists right now, it is the first order, the first version, if you like, of the universe. But it is going to pass away. It's going to be superseded. It's going to be supplanted. Four times in these verses, we have the word new. There's going to be a new order. There's going to be a new version of the universe. And this is the thing then, it's once that great transition has occurred, it's then that death shall be no more. Look at verse 4, and near the beginning then it makes this claim, death shall be no more. And then you jump to the end of verse 4, and it says, for the former things have passed away, or for the first things have passed away. As I said, that's the real Greek word there. Death then is one of those first things. It belongs to this first version of the universe. It doesn't belong to the new version of the universe, and so as soon as that new version of the universe is here, death shall be no more. And it's very important that we're clear then that that's when death shall be no more. It's once this enormous transition has taken place and the new version of the universe is here, it's then that death shall be no more. It's very important we're clear on that, because it means then that it's not when we have mastered artificial intelligence and we all have microchips within us and we've managed to thereby upgrade our humanity to a new level. It's not then that death shall be no more. It's not when we have grown up enough as a race to stop fighting wars against each other and we are instead devoting vast proportions of our national budgets to conquering cancer and heart disease. It's not then that death shall be no more. No, death will survive all of those developments. It will survive every scientific breakthrough and every technological advance. We're not waiting for enough cash to be thrown at this project and then we'll see the back of death. We're not waiting for there to be enough geniuses around in the world and then we'll see the back of death. We're not waiting for there to be enough collaboration going on between the nations and then we'll see the back of death. No. No, no. Understand this. It's only when a voice finally thunders through the cosmos announcing, I am making all things new. It's only then that death shall be no more. Don't be duped by the hubris of our age. Don't be deceived by the modern confidence in labs and research and computers. Labs and research and computers won't make any difference to death. Scientists and tech people can huff and puff and try this and that. The graveyards are going to keep filling up. The crematoriums are going to keep being a daily conveyor belt of funerals. Death is going to stay with us and it's going to retain its 100% hit rates. Only the passing away of the universe itself in its present form will usher in the death-free reality. Nothing else will. Nothing prior to that. And so let's be crystal clear before we go any further on that timetable. So that's the first thing this morning, the time. Secondly, the place. The place. So I've referred to this new version of the universe that there's going to be, and the emphasis has been so far this morning on the word new. But now I want to stress the word universe. Because it is going to be a new universe, or in the language of verse 1, a new heaven and a new earth. That terminology, as most of you will know, can be traced all the way back via various other biblical texts to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, which of course is the start of the Bible's creation account. So that there's clearly nothing airy-fairy about the phrase, the heavens and the earth. What does the heavens and the earth denote in the Bible? It denotes atoms and organisms and enzymes. It denotes thermodynamics and electromagnetics and gravitational waves. It denotes a concrete, physical realm where the laws of physics and chemistry and biology apply. It denotes a cosmos. A universe. That's what that language denotes. And when, therefore, the Bible refers to a new heaven and a new earth, that's what it's talking about. And yes, this new order that's coming will be very new. New, no doubt, in ways that you and I cannot presently even imagine. But it won't be new to the extent that it's no longer a concrete physical realm. Because in that case, it wouldn't be a heaven and an earth. Some different phrase will be required to describe it, because the language of heaven and earth cannot refer to anything but a concrete physical realm. And it's there then, it's there that death shall be no more. Imagine you go into your bathroom one day to have a shower. But the first thing you notice as you walk into the room is an issue with your towel, your favourite lovely soft white towel. And the issue with it is that there's a huge spider right in the middle of it. So what do you do? Well, if you're a competent sort of person and troubled by spiders, you coolly extract the spider from the towel and you go ahead as planned and you use that towel to dry yourself after your shower. If, on the other hand, you're a numpty who finds spiders problematic, then you still find a way of dealing with the spider, but you probably ruin the towel in the process. Perhaps you get a shoe. And with the shoe, then, you wallop the living daylights out of this spider, which certainly removes it from the land of the living, but leaves its internal organs kind of spattered across your towel, not to mention the dirt that was on the bottom of the shoe to begin with. Or perhaps instead of that, you elect to kind of scrunch up the towel with the spider in the middle, to run at breakneck speed to your back door, to toss the whole thing into the garden, and then shut the door very hard again. And whichever of those two methods you use then, whether the shoe one or the back garden one, you deeply regret having to forfeit that favourite towel of yours, because it's a lovely towel, but it's just the price you have to pay to be rid of that creature. And we might ask the question then, has death so firmly embedded itself within, has it become so much part of the fabric of matter, physical matter, that in order to get rid of death, matter itself has to go, just like the towel had to go? And it's thus some kind of intangible, dreamlike realm in which death shall be no more. Is that the case? And the emphatic answer is no. No. God is able, when that great transition comes that we've been talking about, God is able to extract death while retaining all the physical things that death used to prey upon. Think again of Mike Lynch, whom I talked about at the carol service last weekend. And that dramatic night then in August this year, death came to Mike Lynch as he was on board his luxury super yacht. And what did death work through that night? What did death use? How did death get to him? Well, it got to him through the meteorology of that fierce Mediterranean storm. And then it got to him through the physics of the capsizing of his boat. And then it got to him through the biology of seawater filling and disabling the man's lungs. Death, as it were, seized upon all those highly physical things. And this realm, then, that's been described for us in verse 1 of our passage, it will feature those same physical things. It's a new heaven and a new earth. So there'll still be meteorology there, and there'll still be physics there, and there'll still be biology there. But those things will no longer be vulnerable to death hijacking them. Death will no longer be able to enlist those things in its service. In 21st century Britain, everything has to be pathetically stripped down and diminished, doesn't it, in order to make it safe. So you go to a public bonfire on November the 5th, and there's no bonfire. Or if there is, you have to stand about half a mile from the thing behind a safety cordon. You go to a football match, and there's no atmosphere, because all the terracing's gone, and everyone has to sit down sedately as though they're at a tea party or something. Well, I'm saying God doesn't have to strip down and diminish this future realm that we're talking about in order to make it safe. He doesn't have to replace this present order with something much more wispy and ghostly and insubstantial in order to make it death-proof. No, it will be a full-blown, three-dimensional, multi-sensory, physical universe. And there, in that kind of place, death shall be no more. What a God he is. He's able to extract the spider while retaining the towel. the time, the place. Thirdly, notice with me the cause. The cause. Why is God going to do this? On what basis is he going to bring in this new order in which death is no more? Well, in answering that, I want to direct your attention to a detail in the text which may not immediately appear to be relevant. It's the opening part of verse 6, where we read, "And he," that is God, the one on the throne, "he said to me, 'It is done.'" It is done. Does that sound, I wonder, a wee bit familiar? Doesn't it take you back to an earlier scene in the Bible? To a Friday afternoon, one Jerusalem Passover weekend, and to a man hanging on a cross, crying out moments before he died, "It is finished." It is finished, John 19:30. It is done, Revelation 21:6. And I think that connection is worth exploring. What did Jesus mean? What did he mean by "it is finished"? What exactly in that moment is finished? Is it a relieved exclamation in which he's saying, "My suffering is finished now"? Or is it a despairing exclamation in which he's saying, "My poor life is finished now"? Well, no, I don't think it's either of those. I think it's a triumphant exclamation in which he's saying, my obedience is finished now. Remember last Sunday evening, we were in Romans chapter 5, and we said that history has these two giants, these two men of more than ordinary significance. The first is Adam. Adam was given by God a command to obey. He's told that if he doesn't obey, then the penalty will be death. Tragically, Adam disobeys, and that's why there is death. That's why death has that 100% hit rate that I talked about a moment ago. It's all because of Adam's disobedience. Death, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:21, came by a man, Adam. So Adam's the first giant, the second is Jesus. And Jesus then comes into the world to remedy Adam's calamity, to reverse it. Adam disobeyed God and thereby ushered in death. Jesus would obey God and thereby remove death. That's the grand mission that he sets out on. And as we said last week, then the obedience that he had to render to God was way, way harder than the obedience that Adam failed to render to God. Jesus didn't have to refrain from a certain fruit merely. He had to lay down his life on Golgotha's cross. But he did it. He did it. And that's what he means then by that dying exclamation, "It is finished." It's almost a prayer. In that moment, Jesus is calling upon God. "Father," he's saying, "the obedience is complete. The obedience which counteracts and overrides that disobedience in the Garden of Eden, which ushered in death, the obedience is complete. You, therefore, Father, must bring in that new order in which death is no more." That's what's going on when Jesus cries, "It is finished." And what we have here now in Revelation 21:6 is God at last, at the end of the age, answering his son's cry on Good Friday afternoon. Hannah's dad, who passed away last Sunday, was an amener. If he liked something that he heard in a sermon, he would say amen. Many of his generation in the Welsh churches would do that. And this here in verse 6, I think, is God saying amen. He's saying, "Yes, son, your obedience is indeed complete. It is done. And it does indeed counteract and override Adam's disobedience. And thus I am now bringing in a new order in which death is no more." And so back to my heading then, the cause. What's the cause of this wonderful death-free universe that God is going to bring in on that day? The cause is Jesus' obedience. Jesus' obedience. And just think about that for a moment. Think of Jesus in Gethsemane. There's a place in the Lake District that Fraser and I like to go to swim. And it's a longish stretch of a river. It's very, very deep. And at one end of this long stretch of the river, it gets quite narrow, and there's a waterfall. It's not a massive waterfall, and often when we've been, you can swim right up to this waterfall. On one occasion, however, there'd been an awful lot of rain in the preceding days, and the river was much fuller than usual, and you couldn't swim up to the waterfall. And what would happen then, you'd try and swim toward the waterfall, and as you got closer to it, swimming with all your might, your progress would get slower and slower until you were just kind of inching forward. And then you kind of stopped making any progress at all. You're just about to be able to remain where you were as you poured all your strength into doing so, and then your energy would be spent and the current would just kind of whiz you back all the way that you'd just come. And as Jesus then gets nearer and nearer the cross, it's harder and harder and harder for him to keep going, isn't it? He's having to exert all his strength. You can see him that night in that garden. He's having to exert all his strength. Is he going to make it? Is the current coming from that dreadful waterfall of Golgotha, is it just going to get the better of him, rendering him a failure like Adam was a failure? In 2024, it's been another year, hasn't it, in which we've heard of high-profile evangelical ministers failing, falling into serious disobedience. And when you hear then of a failure like that, there's something just so dismaying about it, isn't there? You feel it in your guts. But if Jesus fails, that night in Gethsemane, that's not dismaying. That's catastrophic. Because as his obedience hits the buffers, as his obedience unravels, as his obedience disintegrates, so do all hopes of death one day being no more. If Jesus fails, death has won. If Jesus fails, death is unassailable. If Jesus fails, death is here to stay. It reigns unstoppably. That's what's at stake. Everything depends on that exhausted figure lying on the ground, sweating drops of blood, crying that the cup might be taken away from him. Everything depends on him. And thank God this morning then, believer, that he kept swimming. He kept swimming against those mighty currents. And he reached the cross. And he obeyed to the very end. And there's going to be, therefore, a world in which death is no more. Death hasn't won. Death isn't unassailable. Jesus obeyed. And the basis, then, of death's removal is every bit as strong as the basis of death's introduction in the first place. There was a squalid act of disobedience once, and that's why death is here. But there was a magnificent act of obedience once. And that's why one day death won't be here. Death will be no more. Death will be no more. It's as certain as that death must flow from Adam's disobedience, that a deathless universe must flow from Christ's obedience. The time, the place, the cause. Fourthly, the folk. The folk. And I mean by that the folk who will inhabit this new order and enjoy death being no more. Who are they? What a thing to inhabit that new order. A universe where death is no more. Who are these people? Well, we can say two things about them. They are the penniless and they are the persevering. First, they are the penniless. Verse 6, toward the end of that verse, to the thirsty, this voice continues. To the thirsty, I will give from the spring of the water of life. And then those two words, without payments. Giving from the spring of the water of life then is just a more poetic way of describing inhabiting that realm where death is no more. And this is given without payments. And this flows from then the previous point that we've just been making. Jesus' obedience, we've said, is what secures this new heaven and new earth. It alone and it fully secures it. So that those of us who are here this morning who can say, I'm going to inhabit that realm where death is no more, it's not because we've made a sufficient contribution of our own obedience to the whole thing. In fact, some of us may be here this morning and we've had a very bad week and we can hardly rub together this morning two or three acts of obedience from this past week. But that doesn't diminish our confidence in being able to say this morning, I'll inhabit that place where death is no more. No, we all openly acknowledge, don't we, that our obedience is dreadfully, dreadfully meager. In obedience terms, we are penniless. We're paupers. But that's okay, because the enjoyment of that new world is ours without payment, the verse says. Jesus' obedience requires nothing added to it. The government keeps talking, doesn't it, about this black hole in our nation's finances. There's no black hole when it comes to the obedience that's necessary for getting you and me into the world to come. It's all there through Jesus. Jesus' obedience is enough. We are penniless folk this morning, morally bankrupt, our good works insolvent, our obedience savings account well and truly in the red, and yet we can be admitted into the place where death is no more, because Jesus' obedience pays it all. Jesus' obedience suffices. Jesus' obedience is accepted by the great heavenly banker. Perhaps you've not grasped this. Perhaps you go to bed each night and before you do so, you kind of anxiously tip out your piggy bank onto your bedroom floor and count how many acts of obedience you've rendered. And you go to bed thinking, are they enough? Those two or three coins there on the floor, is that enough? Is it enough to get me into that realm where death is no more? It isn't enough. It couldn't possibly be enough. But it doesn't need to be enough. There's only one person whose obedience is enough, and that's Jesus. And you therefore need to smash up your silly piggy bank, break it into 1,000 pieces, and run to Jesus and request that his obedience be your ticket into the new creation. And he'll grant you that request. He'll grant you that request. It's penniless people who will cross the threshold into the place where death is no more. It's not those who have obedience coming out of their ears. It's not those who kind of waddle in carrying these great money bags full of obedience. Without payment, without payments, Jesus' obedience, the one that matters. Who are these people? They are the penniless, but then also they're the persevering. Verse 7, the one who conquers will have this heritage, which perhaps sounds like scary language, conquering. But in Revelation, conquering is conquering those temptations that there are to give up on Jesus Christ. That's what conquering means in Revelation. In other words, it's persevering with Jesus. That's what conquering is. These first readers of the book are facing persecution. And so there was the temptation because of persecution to give up on Jesus. You and I, then, we're not experiencing persecution, at least on anything like that kind of scale. But there's always the temptation, isn't there? There are always temptations to give up on Jesus. You'll have faced them if you're a Christian. Maybe you are facing them right now. Maybe you will do in 2025. But I urge you, believer, this morning to fight them. To fight those temptations. Without Jesus and his obedience, this future that we've been talking about this morning, it won't be yours. It can't be yours. A very different one will be yours. In fact, the one that's described in very sobering terms in verse 8. Only through Jesus and his obedience can this wonderful future be yours. And so don't give up on him. Don't give up on him. Fight every pressure, every temptation to turn your back, to go for a simpler life where you're not odd and you don't stand out. Fight every temptation. Make it your foremost ambition of 2025 to be this, that on this equivalent Sunday in a year's time, you're still clinging to Jesus Christ. So who are the folk who are going to dwell where death is no more? They are the penniless and they are the persevering. And so we've noticed then the time, the place, the cause, the folk, and then just one last thing as we close, the joy. The joy. Because verse 4, then it doesn't kind of in some very clinical way just announce, does it, that death will be no more. It kind of savours. It savours the demise of death. Death is horrible, isn't it? Death is horrible. And that's captured somewhat in some of the other words that appear there in verse 4. It doesn't just mention death, it mentions mourning and crying and pain. These are the things which death causes in abundance. Death is this grim, grim, grim reality. It's interesting we have that phrase that bothers people a bit at the end of verse 1, the sea was no more. Just two quick things on that. Number one, it's the same formula, isn't it, that we have here in verse 4, no more. The sea was no more, death shall be no more. And it seems there, that suggests, I think, that the two things are connected, that the removal of this sea is of a piece with the removal of death and mourning and crying and pain. And then the second thing to say is that the text is quite precise. It's the sea was no more. It's not seas were no more, all the different seas of the world, but the sea was no more. Suggesting that a particular sea is in mind, a particular sea that presumably the readers of the book will understand what the reference is to, because it's been mentioned already. And there are two seas that have been mentioned already in the book of Revelation. One is that sea of glass, which is before God's throne. It's mentioned in chapter 4, verse 6, and chapter 15, verse 2. There doesn't seem any reason why that sea should be no more. But the other sea is mentioned at the end of chapter 12 and the beginning of chapter 13. And it seems then to be, in some sense, Satan's domain. This place where the dragon goes at the end of chapter 12, and from there he summons this beast. We don't need to go into what the beast signifies, but it's clearly something pretty grim. The sea is this kind of place where the devil pulls out his weapons and pulls out his resources. And it's much more likely, then, I think, that that's what this reference is to. It's not saying that the North Sea is not going to be there in the restored universe, or the Mediterranean Sea. It's saying this sea, Satan's figurative sea, Satan's lair, Satan's den, where Satan pulls out his weapons. And the connection then between that and verse 4, sea be no more, death, mourning, crying, pain be no more, is that death, mourning, crying and pain are satanic kind of things. That's the point. They've got the dragon's foul breath all over them. Some of you know that. You've been through it. You've been through it recently. The mourning, the crying, the pain that comes with death. And it's foul. And it's devilish. And it's diabolical in the literal sense of that word. It's of the diabolos of Satan. And what a thing then, that death will be no more. This isn't just some throwaway reality of the world to come, is it? This is wonderful, that death will be no more, and therefore all these grim satanic things that accompany death will be no more. No more mourning. No more of that aching void that bereavement brings. No more crying. Indeed, every tear will have been wiped away as we enter into that realm by the loving Heavenly Father. No more pain, that heart pain that aches and nags everywhere you go and you can't shake it off because you've lost someone. All gone. All gone. The joy of a realm where death is no more. And so, believer, in a world where death is just all around us and everywhere and we can't avoid it and it's so grim and it's such a shadow hanging over even the best moments in life, believer, look forward to this realm, this new universe, this new order, when death will be no more, when Satan's sea will have been dried up and emptied, because Satan himself will be in another sea, the one that's filled with fire. Look forward to that. Relish the prospect. Don't cling on to any of our society's silly hopes of eliminating death before the new order comes, but look forward to the new order when the voice of God will thrillingly announce death is no more. Amen. We're going to close singing from the projector the hymn, There Is a Hope.